Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
On September 3rd, 1990, Betty Jones and Catherine Krigler were raped and murdered in an unsolved case known as the Labor Day Murders.
You sure you really want to hear?
I do.
This is as bad as it gets.
There was so much blood that it soaked through the carpet.
I never understood how scary it was, that sense of being trapped.
Now more than ever, I want to help solve the murder of my beloved grandmother, Mama Betty. Listen to Knock Knock now on Podcast One, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, this show brought to you in part by SimpliSafe. If you have 30 minutes, you never have to worry about break-ins ever again. Just go to simplisafe.com/Adam, get all the sensors you need, all the help you need as well to set it up. Custom systems going to show up post-haste at simplisafe.com/Adam.
Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal? When it comes to great rates on insurance, for everything, Geico can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance. They are all covered with Geico. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use Geico mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to Geico. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.
Hey, welcome back to Carolla Classics for May 30th, 2022. Happy Memorial Day. This is the show we're going to play highlights of the Adam Carolla Show while the show takes today off. My name is Chris Loxamana. I'm the executive producer of the Adam Carolla Show. And with me, as always, Carolla archivist, superfan Giovanni.
Hey, everybody. We're here again for Memorial Day. Some years we play the comedy clips. Sometimes we do all military. We didn't want to do, again, the thing where we play the same clips over and over from the same people who have served before and the same veterans. And we actually have a series of new clips for you. But we have one bonus clip with some Rob Riggle to throw some funny in.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm really excited for these are all great shows, too. So we're really going to dive in here. So let's kick it off with Rob Riggle. And this is from February of 2018.
Adam Carolla Show 2256, Rob Riggle, talking about going from the military, flying aircraft, eventually transitioning to improv. It's one of the better recountings of his history with a better audio quality. I've played this one before, but it's a real nice, fun way to kick it off.
Rob Riggle in studio. Always happy to see Rob Riggle.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, as a comic, when you go out on the road and you get trapped somewhere, you end up doing things you wouldn't normally do, which is go to the Winchester Mystery House because you got two shows that night, but you got all day.
Yeah.
And where is that? In Fresno?
San Jose.
Yeah, San Jose. They also had a car museum. And the car museum was like, well, there's a 1988 bone stock Pontiac Fiero. And it'd be like, what? This isn't a car museum. This is a place with a roof where cars are parked. But that doesn't make it a museum. And the Winchester Mystery House is like $27. And it's nothing. It's just walking through a house.
Just as nice cars at the airport.
At the airport, absolutely. If you were at SFO, it'd be better. Rob is here. Podcast. Riggle's Picks with Rob and Sarah Tiano have been in here before, yes. Who we enjoy. And then also the movie, of course, 12 Strong, which is out. I saw him hosting NFL Honors, doing an amazing job. I see you all over Fox. I see you all over TV. I see you in features. I see you in commercials. And I always just think, good for you. I don't have the same feelings about Kevin Smith, but when I hear about Rob Riggle, I go, good for Rob. Such a nice guy, good. A veteran. How long were you in the Marines?
23 years. Wow.
23 years. I think years. Mike August always wanted to do a sitcom because he said Rob Riggle was the only Marine station on Manhattan for a while, and he said that's a sitcom. Is that true?
It should have been. It should have been a sitcom. Yeah. No, I was stationed in Manhattan. That was my last active duty station. Well, I take that back. I did. I got called back for a year, went to Afghanistan, and then served down as Central Command down in Tampa. But I was on active duty in Manhattan for a while. Yeah, a little small office, the dog and pony stuff.
It's not all Fleet Week.
We did a lot of Fleet Week. A lot of Fleet Week prep. Yes.
I wasn't on the actual committee.
Post-game, yeah, sure.
Again, according to Sex and the City, that was a very big week for the ladies over there.
It's a fun, sexy time.
Mm-hmm.
It is kind of a... It's a perfect storm in a way. You have just a lot of Marines and sailors hitting port and hitting it kind of hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of ladies in town. It's kind of a happy match.
Yeah, man.
So 12 strong, and I didn't know this, you play Colonel Max Bowers, and you served with him when he was in the military?
He was actually my boss. He was my he was my direct boss. So 9/11 happens. I was in the I had just left active duty in 2000. I was in the reserves in Manhattan. 9/11 happens. My reserve unit's in Manhattan. We were the only reserve unit in Manhattan. So I was activated the night of September 11th. Reported to Ground Zero on September 12th. Worked on the rubble piles from the 12th to like the 18th, and then to the 30th of September, I worked in one police plaza helping coordinate military civilian efforts. I was a captain at the time. My country was just attacked. I was pissed off, so I volunteered to go back on active duty. I had a pretty high security clearance, so I knew they would pick me up, and it didn't take long. I got my orders on November 10th, Marine Corps birthday. November 17th, I reported to Central Command. November 30th, I was in Afghanistan.
Wow.
So when I got to Afghanistan, though, I reported to 3rd Battalion, 5th Special Forces Group. My commanding officer was Lieutenant Colonel Max Bowers. I was a captain at the time. And even though I was a Marine, I was coming from Central Command, so I was attached to their unit. But I worked on his command element, doing civil affairs and public affairs work for him. So I briefed him every morning, briefed him every night. And now I'm playing him in the movie. So I felt like I knew the man.
Yeah.
How much did that help in terms of not your portrayal, but sure. What I'm saying is like getting your foot in the door, getting the audition. I feel like I'm making a movie. I'm just going to give it to the guy who was there.
Knows it personally.
I think it helped. The script, I read the script 5 years ago. Mm. 5 years ago. So, you know, and I went in and I met with Mr. Bruckheimer. And, you know, we talked about it and he asked me, you know, is the dialogue seem real? And I was like, parts of it and parts of it not. And, you know, this isn't how we joke with each other. And we just had kind of a conversation about the script. And then I left, I shook hands and I never heard from him again. So I thought, well, that was that. I must have said something wrong. And 5 years go by and then all of a sudden I get a call out of the blue saying, hey, they're making the movie. They want you to be Bowers. Are you in?
Wow.
I could see Rob getting a little overzealous with this stuff and playing fast and loose with the truth for future ones. Like, hey, we're doing the Robert E. Lee story. Yeah. I know the guy.
Oh, my God.
Send the script over.
Kicked his ass in a bar once.
I can tell you all you need to know.
Oh, you're talking about old Bobby Lee?
Bobby Lee.
Bobby, no, Jesus.
What a handful.
Don't get me started.
He's fine until he gets the whiskey in him.
So,
I have a question.
Yes.
Speaking of what you just said, did you ever notice any ill side effects from being on Ground Zero immediately after? Because somebody heard some stories.
I get asked that a lot, and I got to say no.
Lucky.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just lucky, or I don't know. I've smoked a lot in my 20s. Maybe that's so it all panned out. It all came out. I don't know. But I felt nothing. And for the first couple of days, I worked with no mask on or anything.
God.
And then when they finally did get us mask, it was like a little surgical mask like you see
at the airport.
They're little, what they are, because doing enough construction, they're paper, but you sweat into them because it's like you hold your hand in front of your face, you'll just start immediately sweat up the palm of your hand. And so then they're paper, so they start getting moist, and then you have to kind of pull them down, you breathe, and then you put them back up so you can get back to work, and then you pull it down and breathe again.
It's a hot, wet, stinky mess because your breath is ass, and
right.
It eventually gets all moldy and wet in there, and it's gross. So eventually you rip it off.
The guys you want to hang with on the construction side are the guys who poke the hole in it and push a cigarette through it.
that's good.
That's the dude. That's the guy just got done riding Mexican space shuttle on the porta potty and then the free cowboy hats to the ass liners with the arrow. Like, that's the guy you want to eat lunch with. You want to sit on his pile of drywall when you eat lunch.
Team up with him.
I worked with a guy named Gareth once who every single time he pulled the mask down, he would always go, damn it, there's nothing I could do to save the patient's life. Like, every single time he pulled it out, he was like a frustrated 80s surgeon.
But I love that he went into character.
Every time. Damn it, Liv. Yeah, it was the toughest part of the job. He's like had to go in and talk to the next of kin.
I've done all I can.
I worked in a bag factory in North Kansas City the summer before I went to college. And I was the only one who worked because if you got if you you got more money on welfare than you did if you worked a 40-hour week in the bag factory.
Mm-hmm.
And they would so everybody would try to get fired, because if you got fired, you could go collect.
But if you quit, you couldn't get it.
Exactly. Right. So the and I was a young 18-year-old kid. So and I was, you know, zesty from the suburbs. So I was working hard, and I showed up ready to go with a little spring butt attitude. And yeah, everybody that I worked with, Vernell, Dwayne, Luther, Danny, you know, all
just
the guys,
say all the jizz.
They were all. Safety conscious was not part of their world.
Right.
They would go out at lunch and they would get a six pack, each get a six pack of Natty Light and a half pint of extra dry gin, and they would finish it in 30 minutes.
That's right.
And then they'd come back and drive the forklifts around and all that stuff. So safety on work sites has never been something I've been fortunate enough to enjoy.
They have these 0 days since accident dry erase
always,
board.
Permanently painted. And they would tell the foreman, they would literally get in his face and tell him to go fuck himself, and they would just get all over his case, and he would sit there and take it and go, okay, all right, that's, hey, why don't you calm down now, Danny? And then he'd go, Rob, I need you to do all the work today. And I would get tasked with all the jobs.
Well, this is one of those things, like, depending on where you come from and what you do, like, when I work construction, like, if we did hear about some guy who fell off a ladder and impaled himself on some rebar, but now he was going to get paid for 3 months and didn't have to come, it's like, oh,
lucky son of a bitch.
Sweet bastard. Lucky, sweet. He's probably playing Nintendo right now and eating cereal out of the box.
Yeah, he's loving it.
Out of the box.
He's loving it.
Oh, dude. And
life.
Probably get a new pipe for his jet ski. Because, you know, man, that $1,800 a month.
Oh, I mean, some
Jesus
guys
Christ.
Some
that's
guys
fat
have all
cheddar.
The luck.
I know, we should talk about guys who are insane losers. Kenny Ryback got a job. He's working at Gelson's. He's not a checker, but he's a bagger. But he gets $10 an hour. Golden time, he gets 15 on if he works Christmas.
Guy like, must have like, a horseshoe up his ass.
It's like, it's crazy what you would look at. I had this thing, I don't know if you had this thing, but I sort of went, when I was doing all this kind of work, I remember thinking to myself, even if somebody paid you $15 an hour, mm-hmm. by the hour is just not the way to do it. When the work is miserable, like get paid by the gig. Like mm-hmm. I remember I wasn't thinking about comedy. Yeah. I wasn't thinking, I don't know what I was thinking about, but I had this thought that I picked some insane sum, like $20 an hour. Even if you got $20 an hour, you still wouldn't want to rack up as much of your life at this factory as possible. You'd want to get paid, get your mountain lead.
You have a successful mindset. That's a growth mindset. I do believe that, honestly, because that's how you're supposed to look at things. You're not the hourly wage, man. It's you're never going to be independent on the hourly
well,
wage.
Well, we used to always, with our Art Fuss, he used to run the carpet cleaning job. Art Fuss.
Fantastic.
He used to say to us, like, we'd be getting $6 an hour, and he'd be like, what would you do for $10 an hour? And we'd be like, I would blow Shamu. I would, and he'd pick these like insane jobs. Like I would go into an AIDS hospice and lick the ground without using a mop. Like, and it was $10. That was the high benchmark. The benchmark
was
$10.
But that's one of the oldest games in the world. I remember going to summer camp and okay, how much would it take for you to
blank
eat a turd?
Right.
Okay, well, you know, I'm probably in. To eat
you're
the whole
Philly
thing,
fan,
or take a
just the Super Bowl away,
Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Take a bite of it, or to eat it, and they're like, "Well, take a bite, okay?" For a bite, at least $50K. That's me.
How much were you getting an hour at the bag factory?
I got this is true story. $9. No, that can't be right. Oh, it was $4.10 an hour because I got after taxes a whole 40-hour week. I would clear what my take home was $140.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think you got, now see, you're everywhere. You're doing all these, you have 18 jobs. I feel like that base of the Marines and the bag factory and all that kind of stuff, it's hard to say no to a gig that pays good, that doesn't, that involves some cheese in a green room. Like it all feels like, well, it's all gravy, right? Do you have trouble saying no to things because it all just feels like this isn't a bag factory?
Yes. I mean, especially in the beginning of your acting, comedy, show business career, you say yes to everything. I did because you wanted the gig. You wanted the experience. Yeah. You wanted to be seen. You wanted to build a reel. You wanted to anything you could to just get some traction. You just wanted to get some. So I said yes to everything. And just now, and I know it doesn't feel like it because I've been very fortunate to keep working, but just now I am getting very good at saying no to stuff. But I'm still saying yes to a lot of stuff, but I still say – I'm saying no more than I've ever said before in my life.
I just was reminded by Chris Maxpat of one of my favorite reoccurring roles, Gil Thorpe, the realtor on Modern Family. Unbelievable piece of comedy acting by Rob Riggle.
Thank
it
you.
Is so – my kids love that show.
It is a great show.
And it's really well written and really well done. And Gil – I don't know if we can find some of Gil – interacting with Phil, but
well, there's only three words you need to know in real estate, and that's Thorpe, Thorpe, Thorpe.
Gil Thorpe. I love it. I love how Phil's always defeated by Gil. I love what a pretentious prick Gil
Thorpe
is. He's
just such a perfect foil to Ty Burrell's character because his character is so sweet. He's the nicest guy in the world, and then you need the biggest douche to deal with the nicest guy in the world.
Oh God! When I tell my kids Gil Thorpe is in here, that's going to be a big deal. You may take Uncle Jimmy's place in the power ranking of celebrity friends. Temporarily, he'll start to slide back into number one.
Come on, Oscar time.
my kids are so horrible that my 11-year-old daughter, we're walking Phil, named after Phil Dunphy, the 110-pound lab, to Starbucks the other night. And my daughter just out of the blue goes, hey, Mom, no offense, but if they ever did one of those, you know, occupation days where you bring in a family member and they had to explain what the occupation did, I'd go with Uncle Jimmy. And I said, well, he's not your family. Well, he's Uncle Jimmy. Yeah, no offense, Mom. But just
wow.
So you know, if it happens, and then I said, "Well, what about me? I'm a celebrity." And he's like, "Yeah, no offense."
Wow.
I'm still sticking with Jimmy on this one. I said, "Well, good luck." You know what? Hitting up his publicist. Oh, do we have Gil? Well, hold on a second.
It's the classic no offense, too.
Yeah.
I don't think you understand what that means.
No offense is right up there with, "I'd like to help." No, you would not. You never have. It's never going to happen once you announce. No offense is always wildly offensive, and I'd like to help always equals zero help.
Yeah. Often when they preface it with, don't take this the wrong way, but there's only one way to take it.
Right. Yeah. You already know way. That, which is why you're telling
me. Like, is there a right way to take this horrible
thing? We'll play a clip of Gil Thorpe in a second. First, I'll tell you about the LegalZoom, man. How about we make 2018 a good year with LegalZoom? Finally get serious about launching your own business. Rest easier knowing your family and future are squared away with the right estate plan, LegalZoom. They've been helping people take care of their dreams and responsibilities for over 16 years. Mark Gargis will sit right where Gil Thorpe is sitting, and he will tell you, go ahead and use LegalZoom. Don't use me unless you're Chris Brown and you're being arrested because you took a picture of yourself and a monkey and put it on Instagram, and some do-gooder called the cops and had you and your monkey arrested. LegalZoom. God, I hate people. LegalZoom, not a law firm, but they have resources to keep you on track, including advice from their nationwide network of independent attorneys. No billing by the hour, no billable hours there. It's LegalZoom. Price is given upfront. Start off 2018 with a good story, huh? LegalZoom, Dawson.
Go to LegalZoom.com/Adam and get special savings. That's LegalZoom.com/Adam. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com/Adam.
All right, let's, just because Gil Thorpe, I forgot all about Gil Thorpe. It makes me laugh every time.
Nope. That's my wife. I better take it.
Hey, listen, whatever you do, don't tell her you're playing golf on a weekday. You'll be doing dishes all night.
Good call. Thank you, my man. Hey, honey, what's up? Oh, not much. Just in a meeting. You know, working hard, bringing home the bacon.
No, he's not. He's playing golf.
No.
Four. Nice putt. Why are you lying to your wife, Dunphy? Huh? Hey, he had a beer at lunch,
what
too.
What's wrong with you? You just got torpedoed. Come back here.
Torpedoed.
It's always funny. The old Thorpe is always... God, there's like they're going after the same houses. What was the best one? Was it the, we were just talking about this, weren't we? The, career day. Was there a career? There was a career
day. There
was
a career day when, oh, yes. Oh, God, that was a good. And I handed out Gil Pickles.
Pickles.
Gil Pickles. Yeah. And, Gil Pickles. And then he tried to do, Phil tried to do a interactive thing where he interacted with himself on a TV, but he got out of sync with it, and he could never catch up. And so it turned into this debacle.
Oh, you got to find Gil Thorpe career day. It made me laugh my ass off. All right. Well, we were going to play made-up movie, but screw it. I want to take a break. Oh, well, now we got to watch this, and we'll do some news. But this always cracks me up. It's so good.
Guess what? I've been in your house when you weren't home. And yours. And yours. No, I'm not a burglar. I'm a realtor.
Oh! Hey, sorry I'm late. I just sold another mansion. How you doing, honey?
History is full of great rivalries. Athens and Sparta, Kerrigan and Harding, Phil Dunphy, and Gil Thorpe. In this scenario, he's the Tonya, I'm the Nancy.
Pay attention, kids. You're about to hear from the number four realtor in town.
Anyway, I'm not going to bore you guys with a lecture. Instead, I'd like you to watch as I converse with a young man who's wondering what to do with his life. Hey, kid. Hey, kid. Up here.
Damn it.
Up here.
16-year-old.
He's heard a wick.
What's up? I'll tell you what's up. I'm interested in helping you by telling you all about a career in real estate.
Real estate is not just buying and selling houses. I don't have time for that. Epic fail.
Yeah. Sounds like we need to start at the beginning. You see, real estate is about people.
People?
I couldn't agree more, Phil. Best part of our job is putting the right person in the right home.
Gil.
Matter of fact, last week, I put a Spanish couple into a Spanish home.
A world without houses. That's cray-cray.
Okay, okay.
Phil, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to screw up your little show. I know timing is critical on these things. Gil, believe me, the last thing I wanted to do was...
You sold the house to the Channel 7 weatherman?
No, no. But I did sell one to Kobe Bryant.
Guess what? He's not talking to you. He's talking to me. And I have a very funny story, actually. A guy walked into...
That's hilarious.
No, I haven't told it.
Okay.
The concern teacher.
Great throw. You were right. It is in my court.
Balls in your court.
And guess what? It was me the whole time.
What? Come on, kid. Come on. Give it up. Give it up. He tried. I think we all know what you were going for, Phil. But I'm looking out here and I'm seeing some hungry kids. Am I right? That's why I brought plenty of Gil Pickles! Who wants a Gil Pickle? Come on, let me see him. All right, come on, grab one.
Gil Pickles. Genius. So much better than my pillow cases. Claire wasn't a fan.
One of him in bed is more than enough.
All right, there's Gil Thorpe. Love dick. Gil Thorpe. Such a great dick. I wonder if, I don't know, maybe
a
it's
Spanish
like...
Spanish couple. Air quotes.
I'd like to look it up. I don't know how you do it. But, I mean, I wonder if nicer guys play better douches because they're free.
Yeah, oh,
they're freed up.
Yes. And now stop speaking.
The ultimate guy, Larry Miller.
Larry Miller
the douchebag.
Is the nicest guy in show business.
He's the perfect example.
He always plays a horrible douche of a whoever.
That's right.
But I wonder if there's a part of you that feels... in those quiet hours that you may be kind of douchey that doesn't let you completely. It's my argument with myself. If I was actually racist, I wouldn't make as many offensive racist jokes.
I'd
be guilty. I'd feel weird about it.
Like
I think I look, there's a part of your personality that you never get to take for a walk or you shouldn't take for a walk. And when you get opportunities to play douches, you get to take that guy for a walk. And I mean, let him peacock. So I love playing characters like that. And sadly, I play them kind of well, which means I get offered more douchey characters, which then I get to go play more douches. And then all the characters I play tend to be a douche. So I'm trying to, obviously.
And then when people think of Rob Riggle, they think douche.
Unfortunately, but they think funny douche,
yeah,
which
true.
I can live with that.
My kids love Gil Thorpe. That's all I can say. All right. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back with the news right after this.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gino Grad. Breaking viral. All those crazy Trump tweets. Give me news with Gino Grad. Trouble in the Middle East. Celebrity drunk meltdowns. Need news with Gino Grad.
The news with Gino Grad.
You know, before we move on to that, I have a fun fact about Rod Riggle.
Mm-hmm.
We are from the same town and attended the same high school.
Wow.
That's for real.
We're Nabes.
That's right. We're Raiders.
Yeah, we're Raiders. Go Raiders.
Nothing greater than a Raider.
Yeah, Rob, you must have played football. You're a strapping guy.
I did.
You love sports. What was you played in high school,
yes.
You went to college, and then you ended up in the Marines.
Yes.
So how did that work?
I was a theater and film major at the University of Kansas, but I had my pilot's license.
As was I, but I didn't have that.
Rob followed your footsteps.
I had my pilot's license in undergrad, so I took a test called the AQTFAR for the Marines, and I got a guaranteed flight contract. And so then I figured waiter didn't get laid as much as Top Gun did.
How much flying did you end up doing?
I made it all the way to the advanced pipeline through flight school and the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
I went through AI, went through primary down in Corpus Christi, went through intermediates down there, and got helicopters, and was headed back to Pensacola when I decided, you know, if I pin those wings on, they're going to own me for 10 years before I even have a chance to get out.
So did you always have a thought about comedy?
Yes.
And obviously you performed. I mean, you were in college, you studied it. So, but that's still not stand up. Were you thinking stand up?
No, I wasn't. I didn't know what form. I didn't even know what improv was or sketch, really. I just knew that I loved comedy. I grew up a child of the 80s. So I grew up Stripes, Caddyshack, Meatballs. You know, these were the movies of my youth, the things I rallied around. So I just loved comedy. Didn't understand what it really meant. I just understood I loved it, and I was fairly funny. I was voted most humorous in my senior class.
Oh, look at you!
And like I said, I love theater and film. But again, I didn't know what it meant. So actually, but I did know that if I continued flying, I'd have to do at least 11 years before I even had the option of getting out. And
yeah.
I ended up doing 23 total, so I ended up staying longer.
Jokes on you. Very moot point.
But it would have all been active duty, and I would have never had an opportunity to pursue comedy and acting.
I wonder, see, I don't feel like my kids, 11-year-olds who love Gil Thorpe, I don't feel like they're going to deal with that. So many people I talk to were like, I liked comedy, but I didn't know where to go, and I sort of wandered around, and I was the same way. I loved comedy. It was completely rudderless. I had no idea how anything worked or who you could talk to or what you could do. And now one of the big advantages to being young now is just like whatever you're interested in, you can go look it up, suss it out, research it, and go do it. You can intern, you can whatever. I wanted to get in radio my entire life. I never even know where the radio station was.
Yeah.
Like I didn't know anything. Like didn't have anything on the side of the building. I was at Pasadena Junior College when I was, 28, just wandering around going, do you guys have a radio show or something? And they're going, yeah, we have a station, but you can't be on it. And I'm like, why can I audition? And they're like, no, you have to enroll in this. And then you take voice and diction. And then you go talk to Mr. Tomey over there. And then you go figure out this. And then 5 semesters now, maybe we'll give you a shot talking to Mike that's not hooked up. Like, I was just like wandering. I was just like wandering around, and everyone's just kind of going, go home, We don't know, go home.
A lot of barriers to entry.
Yeah, and then you just go back to the construction site and talk to guys, and they're like, I don't know, I don't know anybody. And that'd be it. You just go back home again.
Totally. I totally agree. And you got to remember, I'm down in flight school in Corpus Christi, Texas, and I'm like a second lieutenant, maybe a first lieutenant at this point. But I know nobody in show business, nobody in comedy. I know nobody in this world. I just know that I want to do it, and I know I got to try it, or I'm going to fucking die if I don't try it, or I'll always regret it. So that's when I stopped flying, and I stayed in the Marines and fulfilled my ground contract. I just became a ground officer instead of a flight officer. So I became a ground officer. Great. Did my time in North Carolina, knocked it out. Awesome. And then I'm moving to Chicago because I heard that's where Belushi and those guys started at Second City. And that's where I'm going to go. And I literally had a plan. I had a buddy I was going to live with. I was going to bartend or wait tables and go do improv. That was it. And then the Marines came and said, well, hold on. I just got promoted to captain. They go, what would it take for you to stay in? And I said, I have a plan. I'm going to Chicago. And there's no military or there's no Marine Corps base there. But they said, well, we've got a small office in New York or Los Angeles. And I said, if you can get me to New York, I'll extend. I'll give you 3 more years on active duty, but I won't augment. And they called my bluff. Next morning, I had orders to New York City. So I was like, well, shit.
Where physically was the office in New York City?
3rd Avenue and 49th.
Oh, so it's right in there.
Yeah, yeah. And it was up on the, well, I don't know what floor, because there are any terrorists listening.
3rd Avenue and 49th. Yeah, that's right there, man.
Yeah, it was right by Smith and Wolinsky's, right there.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. So anyway, so I got to New York. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anything. And I wandered. I was living on the Upper East Side, so I wandered over to the Comic Strip Live up there on 82nd and 2nd. And I said, do you guys teach comedy? Like, that's how naive I was. And they go, well, yeah, there's a guy here who teaches a stand-up class. Great. Sign me up. I'm in. So I took his class. It was awful. Not him. I mean, he's fine. He does whatever. But his style was 3 jokes per minute, set up punch. And that wasn't – I was more of the Eddie Murphy, you know, delirious, where you tell stories. And in the process of telling a story, you have characters and da-da-da-da-da. And I hated it. I hated it so much. I can't even tell you how much I hated it. I hated the class. I hated the people in the class. I hated the teacher. I had to get up and do 5 minutes. I blacked out because I was so nervous that I did the 5 minutes, but I didn't know what I did until I watched the videotape when I went home. Mm. And I watched the tape and I got through it, I guess, but there was a lot of, is this thing on? I said that. I don't remember saying that. Just crazy. And I remember thinking I made the biggest mistake of my life. I think I was like, I could be a pilot right now. What was I fucking thinking? And I was so mad at myself. And then a friend of mine said, hey, I've got a friend you should talk to. So I go, oh, it was Dave Koechner. And I called Dave and I go, Dave, you don't know me from a hole in the wall, but we have a mutual friend. He said, no, I've been expecting the call. What's going on? So I broke it all down for him. He goes, well, dude, you got to try improv and sketch, man. And I was like, what is that? You know, right. and there's nothing here. The only thing in New York at the time was Chicago City Limits, which is short form, gamey type improv. Right. So I was like, I don't want to sing songs and, you know, try to decipher fart codes and all this stuff. So I was like, I don't know if that's for me. He goes, no, I got some friends that just moved here a year ago. From Chicago, Amy Poehler, Matt Walsh, Matt Besser, Ian Roberts. It's called the Upright Citizens Brigade. Go see their show. They do it on Sunday night. It's called Ask Cat. So I was like, all right. So I went down, and it was like the scene at the Triple Rock Church in Blues Brothers.
The fucking light
hit me, right. And I was like, this is it.
Hand springs all the way down the aisle.
James Brown is there. Like,
all the way down. And I that was it. I was like, this. What they're doing is what I want to do. They were long-form improv. Yep. They were improvising scenes and making shit up and playing with each other and just being amazing. And so I was like, well, that's it. And then that kind of set my path. And then I started studying there and eventually teaching there and trying to get opportunities and – blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, the other part is, you know, not only do you not have anybody telling you what you can do or what to do or any kind of guidance at all, but then you'll run into these characters along the way who are not helping the process at all. They explain this is how you have to do stand-up or this is how it works, and you don't know who you are. All right. You know is it doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a 14-year-old guy struggling with his sexuality. Like, he was like, I find myself more attracted to Jason over there than Jenny over there, but why? And then everyone goes, aren't chicks hot? And you go, yeah, I guess they are. And they go, come on, let's go make out with chicks. And you're like, I don't really want to. And they go, why wouldn't you want to? And you go, I'm thinking about... But you can't really explain it. It's just kind of a feeling.
That's
and then you go to
true.
Tuscany and... our Army Hammer
is there.
Takes you by the hand and you take a little dip in his pond.
There's a tangerine.
You need that thing where somebody goes, you should be doing this. Like, you don't, because you don't know what you should be doing. All you do is you turn on TV, you see stand-ups or you see whatever, sitcom, and you go, I guess that's what you do. Yep. And then you go try it and it's not your sport.
Yep.
And I couldn't agree more. And like I said, child of the 80s, stand-up scene, stand-ups were everything. Sam Kinison, you know,
Dice Clay,
the guy from Boston, Stephen Wright,
right.
You know, like stand-up was everything in the comedy world. I just didn't know there were other avenues. And when you grow up in Kansas without an internet, you just don't know things. You don't know things. And so
he speaks the truth.
Wonderful. There was wonderful things of guiding hands like that, like you're talking about, like Koechner reaching in and saying, maybe you ought to consider this. And
yeah,
had he not
said
that, I probably would have never found that path.
There's also maybe, though, on the bright side, Rob Riggle.
Yes.
Riggle's Picks. It's on Apple, a podcast one, and Apple Podcasts, well, every week. there's something about a naivete and a discovery process that's kind of dreamy in a weird way. Like, I could remember, like, my son, he goes on the internet and he's like, I want to have my own YouTube sports channel and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's all not, he'll either achieve it or he won't, but it's all kind of laid out.
It's accessible.
Like, I remember when I first met Kimmel, and he was like, you got something going on. And I'm like, what is it? Tell me. And he's like, something. And I was like, what are we going to do? And he's like, we should do something. And I'm like, but what? What can we do together? Right. No one's going to let us do anything together. And he's like, well, we should think about it. We should eat and think about it. You know? Let's do it. But there wasn't, oh, I know a guy and is over at Netflix and he can set a meeting up and we're going to go pitch. And it wasn't that laid out. So it was a lot of like, what does the future hold?
Yeah.
And it was a little bit magical because it was like, we didn't know what was around any corner.
That's the beautiful part about it too. And about successful journeys, those are always the first step is just taken in faith. You know, you gotta just put yourself out there and risk the failures and risk the blows that you're going to encounter. But that's where I think that's the difference between people who do stuff in this world and the people who don't. The people who don't just, there's an old saying in the Marines, you know, the people that's, you know, the cowards, the weak fell out along the way and the cowards never started, you know, and, you know, I get people, young people all the time saying, well, how do I do it? How do I do it? And what they're really asking is, how do I do it without having to work?
Can you fast track me?
Exactly. And I don't blame them. Everybody seeks out the path of least resistance. I get it. I did. But the truth at the end of the day is you got to go. You want to be an actor, get on stage. You want to be a comedian, get on stage. That's the only way to do it. There's no way around that. They don't want to hear that, but that's just the cold hard facts.
Yeah. Well, I've found the biggest, where I know, when I know somebody's not truly into it or interested, is when they want some projections of what the income might be or what the reward might be.
Well, so they're dabbling.
Yeah, they go, well, how, the number one question they ask, which kind of makes me realize they're not really into it, they go, but how did you know? How did you know? How'd you know it was going to work out? How'd you know, you and Kimmel? How'd you know about the podcast? It's like, I never knew. Nobody never knows. It's an impossibility.
Exactly.
It's things, certain things we did weren't even invented. So we'd have no possibility of knowing anything. We did it because that's what we wanted to do.
Right.
It wasn't, if you would say to anybody, hey, I'll give you $1 million if you go down this road and explore this thing, I go, there's $1 million at the end. Like, yeah, of course, everyone says yes.
Yes.
The real person is, the person who wants to do it is where you go on that journey and go walk 1,000 miles. And when you get to the end, there may be nothing there. Or you may be out some money.
Right. But, and that's, you know, and look, as you go through life, you don't go on through with blinders on. You know, if you start doing comedy and you suck, the crowd's going to let you know. People are going to let you know. And you can figure it out. You don't have to go 1,000 miles. You could go 10 miles and go, oh, I hate this. And they hate me. You know what? I'll be an agent.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
That's
yeah.
How that works.
Or let's say you have no talent and no soul, and you say, I'll be a publicist. Like, you know what I mean?
There's all different levels.
There's a lot of different levels, yeah. A lot of different stratas.
You know what I'm saying. You start, you guys, you just got to go. You got to do it. There's no shortcuts, and there's no guarantees. That's a lot of people want promises. There's no promises. And all these cliches do come into place. The cliches don't fall out of the sky. They're there for a reason. And it's true. And I just, the cliche just flew out of my mind. I totally forgot it.
But I'll buy you some time by saying, if you love playing basketball and you love playing pickup hoop, then you just go play pickup hoop. You don't go, is there a piece of pie waiting for me at the end? You just go do it. And if you have to ask, like, well, what do we get? Do we get free pie after the game? Then you're not into it. You're not into picking up hoop. You should treat comedy or acting or writing or whatever, treat it like you love a sport.
Like, no,
and certain amount of people do get paid to play full time, and that could be you, but you have to be a person who just is passionate about the sport. And I it always drives me nuts when I talk to some actor and I ask them what they're doing, and they're like, I audition for commercials. And I'm like, well, but why aren't you doing a play or something? So it takes up a lot of time. You got to go down to the church basement. They don't pay anything, you know, so I'd rather just go out for a gum commercial. And it's like, then you're not.
Yeah,
I used to
beg my improv troupe, because we used to have to pay for rehearsal space. Yeah. And I was like, guys, you know, none of us have any money. This sucks. Let's not pay for rehearsal, but let's go in the park and we'll put a hat out and we'll just do skiings. What we normally do, but we'll get paid. You know, we may make a buck or two and we don't have to pay for the space and we'll put on shows and let's just go do it in the effing park. And they go, oh no. What don't you know? Let's just go do it. I wanted to do shows all the time. I'm down for bits constantly. Even just sitting out here on the couch, I could do bits all day. Like it's in the blood, right? It's just part of what you do.
Yeah, I mean, I was at the Acme Theater. I mean, you'd have to pay dues. Like it's like when people go like, you didn't get paid. It's like, it's the opposite of me not getting paid. I paid. It was $50 a month and I didn't have car insurance. Like I'd go work it off like at the theater and stuff like that.
Same thing at the UCB. And I love these. I feel like I got a graduate degree in comedy from the UCB. I learned a lot about writing. I got so much stage time, sketch, improv. I learned so much. I made so many great friends and connections. I wouldn't trade a second of my time there. I've never once in the 15 years that I've been doing improv at the UCB, never once have I been paid. them. And I don't want to be paid. I never asked to be paid. I don't expect to be paid. It's not something that's ever on my horizon because they gave me something else. You know, they gave me that stage time and they gave me an education and they gave me a place to play and grow and learn and fail and all those things. So but I've never been paid. It cost me money to take the train or take the bus or the, you know, on rainy nights, a cab down to the theater. It cost me money. And I gladly handed it over because I felt like what I got back was 10 times more valuable.
That's the attitude. Love that. Semper Fi, man. Let me tell you about LifeLock. Celebrations for dads and grads are perfect for e-card scammers. Clicking a fake e-card can install malware, pop-up ads, or steal your information. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Your personal info gets exposed so often, it's so easy for cybercriminals to steal your identity. Protecting your identity can be easy. With LifeLock by Norton, LifeLock detects and alerts you to potential identity threats you may not spot on your own, like crimes committed by thieves pretending to be you. If you do become a victim of identity theft, a dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. It's LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can keep what's yours with LifeLock by Norton. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year with promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LifeLock or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
And that was a hilarious Rob Riggle in studio, talking about going from the military, flying aircraft, to improv. Unusual route, but he was very successful, and I love whenever Rob's on. All right, let's get going with our next clip today. This is from March of last year. What do we got?
It's Adam, Gina, Brian, Admiral James G. Stavridis, and Elliot Ackerman. They're all talking remotely. It's a really interesting conversation. Gets into China. It's just seemed like an appropriate conversation to have today. A little more dry than the last clip, but still fun. Check it out.
And now, a tip from the 1965 issue of Good Housekeeping. 120 ways to please a man.
Men find certain feminine sins hard to forgive. Are you guilty of lipstick on your teeth? A slip or strap that shows? Fussing when the wind whips your hair? Neatness, in his eyes, is a feminine virtue, so make your cosmetic corner a shining showcase.
Just one of 120 ways to please a man. Now back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Well, we have Admiral James Stavridis and also Elliot Ackerman. They have a new book, a newish book, 2034, a novel of the next world war, and it involves China. And I should tell you that these guys know of what they speak because I got their bio and I read it earlier. So, Admiral, let's start with you. Your experiences. You've worked on destroyers. You've worked on aircraft carriers. You've led battle groups. Tell us, brag for 10 seconds about your bona fides.
I'm a Naval Academy graduate and a long career in the Navy, including command of a destroyer, a squadron of destroyers, a carrier strike group, all in combat. So I know the front end of the spear, so to speak, in that regard. And I also, and this relates to my good friend and co-writer, Elliot Ackerman, I went to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, did a PhD there in international law, and then became the dean. So I have sort of the policy side of this thing as well as the operational side of it.
And Elliot, your turn to brag.
I'm a former Marine Corps and CIA officer, served 5 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, fought in the Fallujah battle there. I'm also a graduate of the Fletcher School, and about 10 years ago started writing full-time. I'm a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times, and my books have been nominated for the National Book Award, the Carnegie Mellon Medal in fiction and nonfiction.
So as coincidence would have it, I don't know if you guys caught it, but I was watching Tucker Carlson last night, and he was talking about that your book is a geopolitical thriller that imagines a Navy clash between the U.S. and China in the South China Sea, 2034. He did a whole piece on the Chinese Navy and how they've really been upping their game with modern equipment and stuff like that. It just ran last night. Did you guys catch that?
I did not, but I watched closely the testimony of a fellow named Admiral Phil Davidson. Admiral Davidson is the 4-star admiral in charge of all of the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. He's my counterpart from the days when I was Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. So he's the Pacific version of that. He was testifying in front of Congress and made some very strong points about the fact that the United States can't simply assume we're going to win a conflict with China. He called it a turning point in the military relationship.
How serious is China about their 100-year plan?
They are 100% serious about their 100-year plan. And I would tell you they actually have a 200-year plan. This is a nation that historically has thought in a long sweep of time. It's an ancient civilization dating back thousands and thousands of years. And that's an advantage that they have over us. So to bring it to the present, one of the key elements in that long-range plan is ownership, as in territorial sovereignty over the South China Sea, the entire South China Sea, which is the size of the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Sea combined. They claim to own it, and the novel 2034 begins with a set piece, a battle in the South China Sea between the U.S. and China.
Are we, it's just a sort of Navy geek question. Are we going to need aircraft carriers in the future, or are we going to have some other way to distribute planes and bombs and things of that nature?
That's not a geek question at all. That is a very powerful question for the moment. And the short answer is, over time, we are going to have to distribute firepower more broadly, as you put it. We'll probably have somewhat smaller but more carriers. And over time, it's not inconceivable to me that we would move out of the paradigm that hooks us so firmly to these carriers. I'll point you back to 1941, what happened on December 7th, Pearl Harbor. Correct, in Jindrad, and the entire U.S. Navy battleship fleet, which was the aircraft carrier of the time, if you will, was sunk in Pearl Harbor. So we turned to the aircraft carrier. Over time, I think there'll be a new generation of ships that will allow us to distribute that firepower more effectively.
Another weird side note, as I was hearing about your story, Admiral, I said, I wonder if he knows of, I know your dad was in the Navy as well, correct?
He was in the Marine Corps.
Oh, the Marine Corps. Anyone know Jim Morrison's dad, the Rear Admiral? You did.
Wow.
I was when I first graduated from the Academy in 1976, he was a 2-star admiral, and he came and visited the school where we were. And of course, we were all in awe of him because he was Jim Morrison's dad, which is probably what's on his gravestone now that he's passed away.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword being Jim Morrison's dad, because on one hand, you're Jim Morrison's dad. On the other hand, your only son says you're dead. I wouldn't take as a compliment, but...
Have you ever been to the grave of Jim Morrison?
What's that? Oh, I've been to the grave, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the very famous cemetery, as you know, in Paris. And, you know, he lived a full and a fast life.
I agree. Not usually a lot of Admiral traffic around Jim Morrison grave. A lot of Heshers, you know, hanging out and spilling a little Crevassier on it. But
it's disproportionate.
Yeah, I walked over there.
Of that generation, you know, I listened to The Doors and Jim Morrison sort of figured in my teenage years. So when I was in the cemetery, I definitely made it to the graveside.
Sorry, Elliot, go ahead.
I just say I think The Doors transcend generations.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Timeless stuff. We've had Robbie Krieger and Densmore, I think, have both been on this show. All right, let me play this clip from Tucker Carlson last night, because it was just last night he was talking about the Chinese sort of gearing up for the naval battles in the future, and it's just a complete coincidence that you guys are on less than 24 hours later. Here we go.
Last year, we learned that China has quickly developed the world's largest naval force. In 2015, China had 255 battle force ships. Now they have more than 360. And many of those ships are more capable than anything in the American naval fleet. So how are we responding to this? Well, at the White House yesterday, Joe Biden addressed it effectively. What's the American military's response? Here's what Joe Biden said.
Some of it's relatively straightforward work, where we're making good progress designing body armor that fits women properly, tailoring combat uniforms for women, creating maternity flight suits, updating requirements for their hairstyles. And some of it is going to take an intensity of purpose and mission to really change the culture and
you
habits.
You can pause it. All right, that's him busting Biden's chops, but it is... It is interesting that China's added, I don't know, was it 100 and some odd ships in a short period of time? And then what about that assertion that they're going to have stuff that's better than our equipment?
I think that overstates what's happening. China has about, to give you the numbers, China has around 370 so-called battle force ships. These are simply warships that are capable of operating at some distance. The United States has about 300. So it is a correct statement that China has more of these battle force warships than the United States. But if you put them all together and had them fight each other, the United States would easily win, because our ships are more capable. And in particular, in today's world, we have these nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. What we got to worry about is the following. If we ever did get into a battle with China, China would be fighting that war on their home court. They would have operations in the South China Sea. They would have the aircraft operating from land bases there. It would be a tough fight for the United States. I still think we have the capability to prevail, but that gap is closing, and I think that is accurate.
How many years into the 100-year plan are we?
Well, as you might or might not expect, the 100-year plan is revised every 5 years or so. So it's kind of a rolling timeline. But I think a fair way to think about it is China began to think holistically about what they call One Belt, One Road. It's a geoeconomic, geopolitical strategy, realistically about 10 years ago, as they really lifted the majority of their population out of poverty. So they're at the very early stages is the short answer to the question.
Brian.
I have a question. I just thought of this because the clip Adam played was the stats that Tucker quoted, I just realized, were between 2015 and today. And of course, it turned into a burn on Biden. But were we too soft on China? Should we have been doing more, or is this just the natural evolution of the last 4 years?
No, we should have been taking a more assertive stance with China. I would argue going back to not only the Trump administration, but before that to the Obama administration, and before that to the Bush administration. Really, the bet in the international system was
that, boy, they're coming for you.
Yeah, satellite.
That's right.
Yeah, it's my satellite alarm. The Chinese are looking. Mostly they find me by the reflection.
Sure.
The bet in the international community was that by allowing China to integrate in through the World Trade Organization, to give them a lot of space, that gradually they would come to become a positive player. That really hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. And they've simply become more aggressive, more sharp-elbowed in business. They've built up their military. They're leaning on small countries across this one belt, one road. It's become pretty clear that China is our major geopolitical and geostrategic opponent, certainly for the first part of this century. I think that light has gone on, both on the Republican side and the Democratic side.
How difficult, I'll pose this one to Elliot, you know, the nuanced relationship with China is, you know, back in the day, you had your enemies pretty well defined, Nazi Germany, later Russia, Japan, you know, we knew who we were fighting. But we didn't have LeBron James defending Germany, and we didn't have Disney, you know, making their product so we wouldn't offend Imperial Japan or the Soviet Union. Now there's this weird blurred line, which is we need these people. They're making our phones. They're making our tennis shoes. No one wants to offend them. God forbid somebody from
watching our movies.
Yeah, somebody from the NBA says he wants to stand with Tibet. He wanted to stand with Hong Kong, and he gets shouted out of the league by all the NBA players. I mean, this is a totally different situation. And how do we make our way through? How do we navigate this?
I think you showed that clip, or what Tucker was getting at, to select that clip with, you know, Biden's reaction to this announcement of what's going on in the South China Sea, is to discuss the latest in maternity garments and form-fitting body armor, is to kind of get at this theme that when the barbarians arrive at the gate, we're probably going to all be arguing about what pronouns to assign them. Instead of actually like dealing with the threat. And, you know, and we, one of the things we very much get out of the book, I mean, it's focused on China, but it's also focused on the pervasive political dysfunction that exists in the United States right now that makes it very challenging for us to put together any type of holistic, forward-looking response to not necessarily a China-specific threat, but any type of threat. However, speaking to the China-specific threat, like, absolutely. We're living in a society right now where we are, if not directly, certainly indirectly affected by China and everything from our sports, you know, LeBron James, our media. Listen, if you go, I'm not saying this to toot our horns, but if you go on Amazon right now, our book is number 7 on Amazon. I've published, this is my 6th book, The Admiral's 10th. I have never in my life received so many 1-star reviews. I usually get about like 60% 1-star reviews. We've got over 60% 1-star reviews.
You know, you made it.
Yeah.
I mean, take a look. I mean, listen, I'm scratching my head. We are enmeshed in every single way, and to pretend this isn't going on is lunacy.
Yeah, look, we're a dream come true as a superpower, because what a delight it would be if you had a foe and that entire country that was your foe was arguing about how racist they were and trying to figure out the gender pronouns and canceling Speedy Gonzalez while you were just building up your fucking fleet. It's insane that we bought into all this stuff.
Well, they're not arguing about that.
We are. Yes.
I'm saying the fact that they're not should concern us.
Yes.
The fact that, you know, what are we, you know, we just spent the last, 3 or 4 days talking about
Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
I know. They're not even from here. We don't even like them.
The Chinese were teaming up to own space together.
it's yeah. We're just like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
The word I like to use is decadent.
Yes.
It's decadent behavior. I myself, you know, I'm a veteran of our wars. 20 years of war is really decadent late empire behavior. And it's worth us waking up to that if we want to have another American century. And I think one of the inspirations for the book was to try to just, you know, shake people by the collar and say, you don't want 2034 to look like this 2034.
Well, it's sort of like, I know everything is problematic in our society, but there's real problems out there. And we'll fucking long for the days when we're arguing about Speedy Gonzalez and Dr. Seuss when the shit goes down.
Well, it's a great luxury to be able to have the arguments about what we're going to paint on the side of the basketball court while we're all eating nachos.
Right.
And if we get our act together, we're not going to be able to have those arguments anymore.
That being said, Admiral, how pumped are you for Top Gun, the next one? When is that coming out?
Well, it's almost as good as if the Doors were going to put out a new album. It's really that good. I am very excited. The whole Navy's excited. You know, that film came out right after I came out of the Naval Academy, and it...
The Admiral.
I think everybody just froze.
Oh. Oh, man. The internet went down just when we're getting to the real subject I wanted to get to, which is the release of Top Gun.
That's coming out July 2nd.
July 2nd?
Yeah. And I think Newsom just announced reopenings of movie theaters.
Ooh. And then what about Fast and Furious 9? Because if that comes out the same weekend Top Gun's coming out.
I know it got pushed, but I don't know to when.
Well, do your job, son.
I know.
Focus, would you please? Yeah. Man. It seems to me, I'm just going to speculate while everyone has been frozen out with our technological difficulties. It seems to me that with the range of aircrafts improving and with drones and missile technologies, you know, the notion of an aircraft carrier, I'm now looking at Dawson as someone to reflect on. An aircraft carrier is about the oldest idea in the world. Like, we're just going to take a patch of landing strip and put it in the middle of the ocean, and you can land your airplane on that. But it's a very old idea if you really just think about it conceptually. The aircraft carriers are modern. The planes are modern. Things have changed. But the concept of we're going to take a patch of landing field, put it in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, you can take planes off from that. Sorry, hold on.
Okay, here's Adam.
Hold on, we had a little technical lockup. Top Gun. As a recruiter,
we're back.
Well, no, as a recruiting tool, it's got to be huge, right?
Oh, sure. Oh,
it's huge, and it also just kind of rattles the DNA of the Navy in very positive ways. And as I was saying a minute ago, everyone is kind of dying to see what Tom Cruise looks like as a senior officer. Pretty hard to imagine that.
Currently scheduled for a 4th of July release, 4th of July weekend.
Of course.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll all be able to go to the theater for that, because that really is a film you want to see in a theater.
Yes. You know, remember Top Gun? Remember how Top Gun was always the movie that people put on to test out their home sound system? Like, dude, you got to check this out.
Right.
Top Gun. Like, you're going to want to see Top Gun Maverick in the theater.
So what's the future of our Navy? What are we working on? What technology? What are we building? What are we building now that would kind of surprise us, or that may be the future? Is it faster and more maneuverable, or is it bigger? What's the trend?
Three big trends. One, you can't see and you can't touch, and it's cyber. It's building the ability to conduct offensive cyber operations that can get into the command and control networks of our opponents. Number two is unmanned vehicles. That you can picture, right? And we think sort of drones. But I'm talking unmanned vehicles, as in from nanotechnology, very, very small swarms to huge unmanned vehicles that can operate in space, others that can be at the bottom of the sea. But taking the men and women off those platforms allows you to operate them in much more extreme ways in terms of speed and depth and altitude and so forth. And then thirdly, to Elliot's career, thirdly is special forces and enhancing the ability of our special forces teams. Elliot was in the Marine Corps, the equivalent of a Navy SEAL. They call them recon Marines, recon battalions of Marines. There'll be more of an emphasis on using smaller numbers of troops, but more elite, more highly trained forces in the future. That triad of cyber, unmanned, special forces is really the future of the armed forces, well, and pretty much the Navy as well.
It's also kind of the future of fast food, right? Less employees, more... Yep.
Robotics
and out the door. One guy kind of knows what's going on versus a whole bunch of doofuses. I'm sorry, Elliot, did you want to say something?
I just had to interject one moment. Sometimes I do have to jump in with the Admiral and remind him that the Navy SEALs are actually the equivalent of recon Marines, not the other one.
Can I ask, Admiral, because we're talking about, you know, special forces in the future and things being manned and unmanned, I'd love to get both of your perspective on Space Force and if you think, you know, we're going in the right direction or what direction that even is.
Yeah, well, the television series was really dopey.
The Steve Carell.
Steve Carell. But the real Space Force is an idea whose time has come. And it's not big. I think people think it's going to be like some huge force and Starship Enterprise will be driving around out there. No, this is going to be small in the context of the Department of Defense, maybe around 10,000 to 15,000. Remember, there's 1.5 million people in uniform in the Department of Defense. So it's a small number, and their job is to procure and operate the satellite constellations in the sky. But we need them because we need a cadre of people who can truly, deeply, madly focus just on space, because it is going to explode in terms of size, as I was just talking about, more big unmanned platforms up there. So good idea. I would say, to conclude, what we really need more than a space force is a cyber force. A force of men and women who are really focused on this cyber problem. We don't have that now. That's
insane.
Over the next few years.
Yeah. Final question for both of you. What is the end game for China? Do they want more landmass? Do they want everyone sort of under their rule? I mean, I think we can all agree there's nations that are sort of content with staying the size they are, who they are. Canada comes to mind. And then historically, there have been other nations that have wanted to kind of spread their wings a little bit. We've done a little of both. We've gone over, done some stuff, and then we usually come home at some point. What's China's end game? What's the big picture?
I'll take a swing at that. I think that, first of all, you're right to kind of point out nations have DNA about whether or not they are expansionist. China historically has not been an expansionist power. China often refers to itself as the Middle Kingdom, meaning they simply assume that they are already between earth and heaven, therefore above the rest of the world, therefore they don't need to expand. Don't forget, they built the Great Wall of China not to expand, but to delineate the extent of the Chinese empire. What has changed is that China recognizes it has to have a functioning, massive economy to support its massive population. That's what One Belt, One Road, that's their strategy, is all about: exporting finished goods, importing raw materials. And I think where they will go in terms of expansion is to kind of reach out and pull Russia alongside them. And let me tell you something. To the north of China is Siberia. It's the size of the landmass of the United States of America. And only about 20 million Russians live there. It's full of hydrocarbons, natural gas, oil, gold, diamonds, rare earths, arable land, fresh water. China looks at that like my dog looks at a ribeye steak. It looks really, really good. Watch for China not to invade Russia, not to take over Siberia, but to kind of pull them alongside as a bit of a junior partner. That will give them the raw materials they desperately want. And then they'll expand that influence along the route of One Belt, One Road through the Indian Ocean. And the next big target will be Africa. Again, not going to take over these countries. They're not going to colonize them. But what they're looking for is a large global footprint that can assure them of a functioning economy and continue to raise the standard of living within China. That's the goal.
Elliot, are they laughing their asses off at us, like arguing over the Green New Deal every 10 minutes?
I would suspect that culturally we're not impressing anybody in China. But that being said, I mean, just to echo what the points the Admiral was making is, you know, oftentimes the argument that's made against a scenario like what we laid out in 2034 ever occurring is the economic interconnectivity between not only China, the United States, but China and the world. And hopefully we won't see a scenario like that play out. But similar arguments were made at the beginning of the 20th century that the economic interconnectivity of all the European nations, the families being intermarried, would prevent any type of war in Europe. And obviously in 1914 with the First World War, we saw that that was not the case. And, you know, you could have a similar escalation of circumstances in the case with China. And one of the themes we get out in the book, because the book is as much about China as it is also sort of a reflection on the United States, is, you know, if we look at the last 100 years as being an American century, that American century was forged in two fires, right? The First World War and the Second World War. Those were two wars that we did not start, but we sure as hell finished those wars and were the beneficiary of those wars for decades and decades into the future. So in 2034, we imagine a war started between China and the United States. But you have to read the book to find out who finishes that war and how to benefit from it.
Well, the book is 2034, a novel of the next world war. It's available now on Amazon. Don't mind the bad ratings. Those are just the Chinese bots giving it the 1 star. Yes.
If anything, it should intrigue you more.
That's right.
Yes. Admiral Elliot, thank you guys for joining us. Very enlightening stuff. Let me tell you about Solo Stove. This is such a nice piece, especially if you want to get out there and use your yard, but you can use it camping as well. The best moments happen around a roaring campfire. A smokeless fire pit from Solo Stove makes your outdoor moments so much more memorable. This is a beautiful piece meant, don't go out alone. This is family. This is friends. This is a good time. It's stainless steel construction. It regulates airflow to burn more efficiently. So little smoke. It's a piece of technology with no moving parts, but beautiful stainless steel. And you don't get all the campfire fumes. You can sit back and relax and actually enjoy your fire for a change. Lifetime warranty and a 30-day free return policy. It's Solo Stove.
Right now, you can shop Solo Stove's best deals yet during their Memorial Day sale. And use promo code Adam at solostove.com for an extra $10 off. That's solostove.com, promo code Adam for $10 off on top of their incredible Memorial Day discounts. But hurry, the Memorial Day sale ends May 30th.
In that clip from March of last year, we have one more clip for everybody. And this is from May of last year. It's going to feature Jack Carr. I remember Adam being very, very impressed with him.
Yeah, he invited him to stick around for the news. We don't have the news in this portion because it was kind of not as evergreen. But this is Adam Carolla Show 3057 featuring Jack Carr, Gina Grad, and Brian Bishop. It's May of 2021. It's Jack's full interview, and Adam seems to really like the guy. Check it out.
And now, a totally innocuous word that sounds dirty when Mike Dawson says it.
Slippery.
Ew. Let's get back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Navy SEAL. I don't want to say former Navy SEAL. You're always a Navy SEAL when you're a Navy SEAL.
It's usually the Marines that have a hard time with that. It's the former Marine thing that that really trips you up sometimes. But former SEAL is fine, I think, with most of us.
Jack Carr's his name. The Devil's Hand, a thriller, available now on Amazon, everybody. And it's the fourth thriller in the Pulse Pounding Terminal List series. Also, he has a podcast, Danger Close with Jack Carr. Good to meet you, Jack.
Great to meet you, too. Actually, I was scheduled to come on last year right around the time the pandemic hit. So it was like right in mid-April, and then all of a sudden, everything shut down, travel banned. And so I'm glad we're doing it now. It's great to hang out with you guys.
Well, look, we finally figured out how to do this. Now we're all used to it.
There it is. Yep.
20 years with the Navy SEALs, team leader, platoon commander, troop commander, led teams in the Philippines, Afghanistan. What about the Philippines? What's going on with the Navy SEALs in the Philippines?
Yeah, so we had a task force that got put together right after September 11th, and we had a relationship already with that government and in that area of the world well before September 11th, obviously. But they've been fighting an insurgency in that southern island chain for over 100 years now, and there were elements of Al Qaeda. Actually, 9/11, the plan was hatched in the Philippines. A lot of people don't know that. It was approved in Afghanistan, but there was the actual plan came, that was in 1994, 95. They started hatching this plan out there. They were going to bomb these planes that were headed in the Pacific, taking off from Australia and New Zealand and places like that. And they were all going to explode essentially at the same time mid-flight. There was a fire in an apartment in Manila, and the plan got thwarted only because of that fire. But the plan was hatched there, approved in Afghanistan. And then, of course, a lot of the training and the planning took place in Hamburg, Germany, San Diego, California, Phoenix, Arizona. So it's it was international in scope.
Well, let's get back to that original plan. That sounds chilling.
Yeah, it's called Bojinka. Plan Bojinka is what it was called. And part of that was the assassination of the Pope in the Philippines, also in January of 1995. So it was all coordinated and ready to go. So without that fire in Manila in December, I think, of 1994, that probably would have happened.
How many planes did they have slated for the explosion?
So what they found in that fire is they got a computer and they got the hard drives from that computer. They exploited that intelligence. I'd have to go back and look, but it was several planes mid-flight over the Pacific. So yeah, quite not one. I'd say more than one and less than 10. So somewhere in there.
And it was, but how did the fire then give way to the good guys finding out the information?
The fire department came, and two people in the apartment ran. And I think one was apprehended, one got away. He was later apprehended in Pakistan with the Department of the Department of Security Services. DSS got them in Pakistan later that year. But yeah, it was a fire. They were either building a bomb or it was an accident. I've read both things. But fire department came. These guys looked spooky. They ran, and then they recovered this device and started looking into it, and then it fell apart from there.
Well, you know, we have a Filipino producer on this show. So I didn't know that your homeland was also the birthplace of terrorism. But what good news if your country didn't have such shoddy wiring codes. Then the apartment would have never caught on fire and we'd have a bunch of dead Australians. So tip of the cap.
Thank you
for that.
It's possible.
Wow. So you're deployed there in that year or shortly after?
A little after. So, yeah, a little after. So, right on September 11th, I was in Guam. It was my second deployment. And in Guam, it was about the middle of the night, and people start banging on doors in the barracks up and down the hallway. And we had a TV in the basement. So, the whole platoon met down there, and we watched the Twin Towers fall on TV. And, of course, we thought we were going right to Afghanistan the next day. But the U.S. military and political establishment being what it is, it's a gigantic bureaucracy. And it took a little while to get things off the ground. So we ended up flying to the Middle East probably a few weeks later. And we thought, once again, we were going into Afghanistan. But what we did was enforce the UN embargo against Iraq, the oil embargo. So we boarded ships in what was then called the Northern Arabian Gulf. They'd head out of Iraq, take a sharp left-hand turn for Iranian waters, and we'd have to climb on, board them, and turn them around and get them back into international waters before they hit Iran. So that's what we did right afterward.
Bouncer. Other guys went
That's it. A lot of guys went right into Afghanistan, though, but I ended up there about a year later.
What kind of ships were you boarding?
Everything from small dhows to the gigantic class three tankers. So at the time I was an enlisted SEAL sniper. And so I'm on the bridge of these things. And what they would do is they would take barbed wire and take it and string it all over the ship. So if you came in a helicopter and dropped off this fast rope, it would get tangled up in this barbed wire. So you couldn't go in that way.
You couldn't rappel down.
Right. Fast rope is like holding on and you just slide down, but similar, the same thing.
Right.
So we'd go in. So they'd wait till the worst weather, middle of the night, and they'd head out, and then they'd take the sharp left-hand turn for Iran, and we'd have to zoom up on the sides with boats, climb on board, and then they'd take all the ladders that are on ships so you can climb up these different levels. They saw those off, and then all the doors and windows they soldered on, welded on these different sheets of metal so that you had to then take your exothermic torch and saws, get through that, get inside, figure out how to turn this thing around, and get it back in about 15 or 20 minutes to do that.
Wow. So the boat... Let me just see if we can paint the picture. It's nighttime.
Yep.
Terrible weather.
Terrible weather, and the boat's moving at a full clip. I mean, they're not going half speed. They're going as fast as they can go. And you're pulling up next to them in what kind of craft?
Like a smaller, it's called a rigid hull inflatable boat. So it's like 33 feet? Anyway, it's like a small rubber boat, and you can fit it, I don't know, 8, 10, 11 guys on there, something like that. And you had a couple of them, and you'd zoom up alongside, and then you'd throw these ladders up and hook in the middle of the night, pull the hook away, and it would unroll this little thing called a caving ladder, which is about that big. And then you'd climb up this thing, banging off the side of the ship, hoping that it's holding up there with this little tiny hook on it. And get over the side and then clear that ship.
How soon would they know that somebody had boarded the ship? Would they see you coming or no?
I don't know if they would see us coming on their radar or not, or if they had some early warning people out there that were looking with night vision and that sort of thing. They expected it, though. So they expected to be boarded, which is why they would be going so fast in bad weather, take that left and get to Iranian waters as fast as they could. So they expected it. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a good time.
I've interviewed many SEALs and they've talked about many jobs, but I never really thought about that job. God, that sounds hairy because, everyone's greatest nightmare is to fall into the ocean at night.
Not interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And especially during bad weather, but especially right next to a big ship.
From a great height, yeah.
And you got to throw
I did that. I had that experience.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I don't think I've ever talked about this before because most people, we talk about Iraq, we talk about Afghanistan, we talk about direct action missions and sniper missions. So no one really ever asks about this. But after you turn that big ship around, so class three tankers are the gigantic like oil tankers that you see off the coasts of the United States, the ones that come in, gigantic cargo ships. So you turn that thing around, takes a little while, and you get it out there in international waters, and then you bring on what's called a prize crew. And these guys are people who actually know how to drive these big ships. The SEALs, we don't know. We're just knuckle draggers turning this thing around, getting it out of Iranian waters and get it to a place where the prize crew comes on. And these are people from the regular Navy that actually know how to run these things. And then we would turn it over to
the side of a tanker. The side of the ship's got to be five stories, right? I mean,
they're big. They're huge.
It's big.
Huge. Yeah, okay. They're huge.
Sorry.
Sometimes you have to do multiple hooks to get up there. So it's crazy. But at the end of one of these, we get back on our little boats and then we go back to a bigger boat that then takes us to this large amphibious ship that we're working off of. So middle of the night, you know, the seas are still terrible. You have to get back from this little rubber boat onto this bigger thing called a Mark V, kind of like a PT boat. That's the best way to describe it. And then as I was stepping across to get onto this PT boat thing, this Mark V hit this wave and with all my stuff, I was the radio guy. I had the radio, my rifle, full loadout of gear, everything went right between the two, middle of the night. My platoon chief thought that was the last that he was ever going to see of me. But the interesting thing is that my one and only thought was, hey, if I have to drop this radio that has crypto in it, meaning if you lose crypto, then everybody in the theater has to change their crypto and all their radios. And they'll know that a SEAL lost crypto. And so I'm like, I can't drop this pack. I have to swim it. So I swam this thing up just because I didn't want people to make fun of me for losing the crypto in the middle of the Northern Arabian Gulf at night. Mm-hmm. And boat turned around, came back, and they got me out of there. But it was a good time.
I love shame as a motivator.
It is a big motivator.
Yeah.
I almost chose death over shame. Yeah.
Yeah. I wish there was more of that. We were talking at the top of the show about John Popper, who likes from Blues Traveler, who likes his guns, and we're talking about range. And now you're a sniper. You were a sniper. What kind of range did they want you to have as a sniper? And where was the kind of Mason-Dixon line of "I'm not taking this shot because I'm too far out"? What was that distance?
Yeah, well, it more depends on the weather conditions, the wind and on those sorts of things, rather than the distance. The distance is important, of course, but then you have other factors. So a distance in perfect weather with no wind or anything like that is different than full value wind coming from an angle that can throw your round off target. So there's a lot of factors in there, and each one depends on the weapon system that you're using. So for a 50 cal, which we use the bolt action Remington 700 and McMillan 50 cal, that was about 1,600 yards was about what you would be comfortable taking a shot at. So a mile, essentially, with that one.
Wow. Yeah.
Other things like a 300 Win Mag, which was really our workhorse, that was about 1,400. And you felt comfortable out to 1,200. Yeah. Then a 308 or 7.62, you're comfortable. You get dope out to about 1,200, but you're comfortable to 1,000. So each one of those different weapon systems has a different effective range.
Wow.
What would you – Brian's got a question, but first – when you're looking through the scope a mile out with the bolt action 50 cal, what are you really seeing through the scope? I mean, how much of your target are you just seeing their torso? Are you seeing their whole body? Like, what are you looking at a mile out with that bolt
action? More like an area weapon. So you have a scope that is more powerful than the one that you have on your other weapon systems, obviously, because you're shooting farther. You can zoom that thing in. But because you zoom in on those things, that means that if you bump it at that kind of a distance, then I remember it getting very difficult to find your target again, because you've zoomed in like this, all of a sudden you bump in and you're over here, and then you have to go back over here rather than having a larger field of view, being able to see what's going on. So if you're off, you still see your target and you just come back on. So there's a lot of factors at play there. But that one's more what we'd call an area weapon at that range. So you're taking out an engine block, you're taking out a plane, something like that. We use them to take out the speakers that were on these on buildings in Iraq, particularly in the campaign to retake Najaf in the summer of 2004. It was a two-week campaign of urban combat the entire time, and that was against the Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, and that called the Jaish al-Mahdi militia. And they were communicating through this system where they would just talk. So they're speaking Arabic through these speakers, so you can hear it, and they're talking and maneuvering forces via this network. And so we would shoot the speakers with the 50 cal off these the side of these buildings. So it was very very effective in doing that.
Wow.
Brian, did you have a question?
Yeah, I imagine the Navy SEAL sniper community is fairly small. Did you know Chris Kyle? Did you serve them? Do you know him?
Yeah, so we didn't meet. I never met him. He took over from us in Ramadi in 2006, but I'd already moved on to do another special program in Baghdad, so we never
podcast
physically crossed
paths. Yeah. What's that? I said podcast or a real...
Yeah, it was a podcast. I needed to jump on, so I had to get over there.
Did you find movies like American Sniper like realistic, accurate, true to what you experienced? Because that's all we know about the whole experience.
Right. So whoever did the set design on that movie did a fantastic job, because that's what Ramadi 2005, 2006 looked like. Whoever did that, they got that right. They got the uniforms right, that sort of thing. They missed up a couple things, like he calls home in the middle of a firefight, sure. Calls his wife.
Sure.
Like that part, not so much. You definitely get kicked out of the unit and sent home for doing that.
Call the girlfriend, for sure.
Yeah, that's a strange time to pick to call home on the sat phone. But then they also got right what it feels like to come home, the way they visually told that story. Yeah. Of him coming home. I think one time he was watching TV. There's nothing on it, I think.
That's the scene I always refer to whenever that movie it gets brought up. That scene is so chilling. You see him and you hear the sounds of war, like he's watching it on TV, and you turn around and the TV's off.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they got that part right. You're fighting in the streets of Iraq or Afghanistan one day, and then less than 24 hours later, you're home and you're maybe changing your first diaper. You're going through some bills. You're leaky faucet, like all these things that you weren't focused on downrange, because downrange you have your best friends to your right and left, your teammates. You're focused on the mission at hand, and you're not worried about any of those things. And then you come home and they're on your plate again.
Mm-hmm. How would you assess the skill level of the American fighting force and the equipment versus some of the places you're in and what you're dealing with?
Yeah, that's really interesting because the people you're fighting against are essentially, they're using AK-47s and variants. They're making their bombs. They're using the same RPGs that have been around for decades. And you have the most technologically superior equipment in the world. So, and they're not, and look what we've been doing for the last 20 years. So it's interesting to think of it in those terms, those asymmetric type terms. But our equipment got very good over the last 20 years. When we first entered Iraq and Afghanistan, we'd come out of the Clinton years and we were using some legacy type gear. There wasn't really anything to spur that innovation. So we learned a lot. We applied those lessons to our gear and our tactics, and we got very good over the last 20 years at war at the tactical level. Now at the strategic level, so up here when we're talking about our politicians and senior level military leaders, not so much. For whatever reason, they seem unable to grasp what kind of a situation they're committing U.S. forces to. They don't understand the nature of the conflict in which they're engaged, and they haven't really learned over the years. So what we do on the battlefield at the tactical level is we're always learning. We're always adapting to the enemy. Enemy's always adapting to us. We're looking for gaps in the enemy's defenses. We're looking to capitalize on momentum, all these things. And then you have these senior level leaders that seem to just fail upward. So back in World War II, like George Marshall is known for the Marshall Plan after World War II. But really during World War II, what he did was fire everyone who did not meet standards. Anyone who did not perform, gone. And really in Vietnam, we started to see this change where people who didn't perform stayed in those positions. And not only did they stay in those positions, then they either retired to make a lot of money on different boards, or they moved up in the complex. So it's changed a lot over the years, and it hasn't moved back. People aren't held accountable really for performance at those senior levels these days. They fail up.
Well, Biden was talking about getting out of Afghanistan, right? Am I making that up?
No, you're not.
And yeah, no, come.
Is that a good thing? I you know, it is, it's weird that these questions always seem to be unanswerable and we seem to be split. I'll tell you what's vexing to me in this country, but just in the world, you know, someone goes, well, we gotta raise taxes. We'll make more money. And then the other economist goes, no, you cripple the economy. Right. Can we just get an answer to whether this helps or doesn't help? Right. And then you go, we need to pull troops out of Afghanistan. Some of those people over there, you know, some of those people's kids are there. And again, what are we doing? It's an endless war. And then someone else goes, are you crazy?
Yeah.
The whole regional destabilized.
Why can't we have an expert? I mean, is it all political? Can we not arrive at an answer?
What is your politics and everything?
What is your opinion about pulling out of Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think it's about, I mean, it's time to leave. Hopefully, we have put in place different networks that allow us to keep tabs on what's going on there. We've had 20 years to establish different intelligence networks to get human intelligence sources over there at various levels. So say if we went in 2001, 2002, 2003, you establish a source over there who is now not 25 years old anymore. Now he's moved his way up and he's a senior level person. So hopefully our intelligence services have been smart enough to do this. And I hope they have, and I would think they have been. But at the same time, we went in there to destroy Al-Qaeda, to disrupt Al-Qaeda operations. We did that a lot faster than most people thought we could at the time. And then we took on this extra burden of nation building. We decided that we were going to combat corruption in Afghanistan. We were going to do all these things. We were going to look at sanctuaries in Iran and Pakistan. So we're going to do all these things that really have no end to them. You can spend the rest of your life trying to combat the political system and instill these different the Western ideas of democracy into Afghanistan, and you might never get there. So you could spend 50 years, 100 years doing that very same thing. So you have to come to a point where, hey, did we destroy Al-Qaeda? Do we inhibit their operations enough where we can bring people home, where we don't have to stay here forever? And I think we hit that a long time ago. But hopefully we have these intelligence networks still set up there. And also the world has changed. Before September 11th, in the 90s, 80s, you needed a physical place to train. So Bekaa Valley, of course, was one of those places. Hezbollah trained. Afghanistan was one. Sudan was one. There's these different places around the world where you physically needed to go and train and learn these things. Well, now, since 2001, we can do that virtually. Mm-hmm. We can get on we can do a lot of this planning, a lot of this training in a virtual space. So those physical locations aren't as important as they were back in 2001. And like we talked about earlier, a lot of that planning didn't take place in Afghanistan. It took place in Hamburg and San Diego and these other places. So, so hopefully we're taking these lessons and applying them to future decisions in a way that makes us a little wiser, but I'm not hopeful.
Let me just get some clarity. Are we able to train virtually, or are they able to train virtually? Are we both able to train virtually?
Yeah, I mean, we can both train virtually, but if you're a terrorist organization, you're recruiting someone online, then you don't need to get that person a plane ticket from, say, you know, Chicago through Germany to Tehran to then Kabul, what you had to do maybe in the 90s or something like that, but early 2000s. Now, hey, you can go and visit, you can talk about it in a secure
Google Hangout.
Yeah, go to the Google Hangouts or something like that. So there are spaces where you can do that sort of thing. And of course, we're looking at that, but the internet's a big place.
I got Rob Schneider's next film, which is Al-Qaeda IT.
Oh, wow. That's good.
Yeah. He's the bumbling guy. Yeah. He's coming in there. They're always telling him. He gets recruited by the CIA, but he didn't have any training at all. They're pissed off because the virtual training is not going well.
And I don't know if this is going to help at all. Something. I think he might be part Filipino.
Oh, he can do any accent.
Good.
Any accent. So, sorry, Gene, were you going to ask?
I am curious. When you were over there, were you married or did you have kids yet?
I did. So I didn't have kids initially, but I was married and we're still married today. So
God bless
one of the few. Yeah, there's a marriage just take a hit.
I wonder about that. Well, I'm thank you for your candor, because I do wonder about that. I don't have any military in my family and I don't really know anyone. So the one question that I can't ever process is, how can a marriage survive something like this, or why would you put yourself through this? Or I just it feels so counterintuitive to, you know, to be married and then go, bye, I'm going to the super dangerous place, I can't tell you where I'm going, and I don't know when I'll be back.
Yeah, no, it's tough, because you're the pendulum has to be on the side of the team. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to be able to talk to your spouse about that, and they have to be on board with it, because especially as a leader, that's what you owe the people you're taking downrange. That's what you owe their families. That's what you owe the mission. That's what you owe the country. That pendulum has to be on that team. And if you're talking to your spouse about it, for us anyway, we talked about eventually when I'm out of the military, that pendulum's swinging back to focus on the family again. But you have to have a spouse partner that is on board, knowing that they are second. And that's just how it has to be. They are 100% second. Your family is second to the team. And they have to be on board with that. They have to know that.
When you came back,
that's tough. Not everybody can do it.
Oh, sure. And I wonder, I mean, I don't know if you experienced this, but I'm sure it's on some level, like you said, the adjustment. I don't know if it was post-traumatic stress or just that adjustment period. Was your wife understanding to that?
I think the only time I had a hard time coming back was after that deployment to in 2005, 2006. So it was a very busy time in Iraq, and it was one of the best deployments I ever had. It was amazing. We're doing the work every single night. I was attached to it's called the Covert Action Unit that actually inspired my second novel, True Believer. But I got back from that, and I wanted to be back. So I was just thinking, I was like, oh man, I wanted to be back. What are the guys doing tonight? Wow. What's happening? And my wife was like, hey, snap out of it. I was like, oh, okay. You know, like, so that's all it took for us. But other than that, I was usually very good at coming back and flipping that switch, and then going from being downrange, doing that job, kicking those doors in the middle of the night, to now coming home and realizing that, okay, it's time to get back into training and also balance the family and all that stuff. But knowing that, hey, my job now is to take those lessons that I learned on the battlefield, pass those along to the people that we're training up now and getting ready to go downrange with, and being a better operator, a better combat leader because of that experience. So you have to be all in all the time on that if you're in the military. And of course, my experience is very slim in special operations. That was the focus. So I'll speak to that. But in special operations, that has to be your focus. Wow.
The Terminal List is one of your books that's filming a new TV series for your first book. And Chris Pratt is starring an executive producer.
That's right. Can
talk about that. That's exciting.
Yeah. What's crazy is that as I was writing the book, so as I started to get out of the military, that pendulum started to come back. So I realized I'm getting out. I dropped, which it's called dropping your papers. And when you do that, you tell the military you're getting out, and they put you in a different pile, which means that you have to now get out of this gigantic bureaucracy, and you have to stand in a lot of lines. So you go to medical, and you go to dental, and you go turn in gear, and you get right out of secret programs. And to do each one of these things, you have to make an appointment, which are more lines. So you have essentially a year of waiting in line to do all these things, which gave me time to write. And since I was a little kid, I knew that I wanted to write. I grew up surrounded by books and this love of reading. My mom was a librarian. And I knew that was my next thing. So I started writing. And I thought, you know, who's going to play this character? Chris Pratt. And I just had that thought. And he'd only been Andy Dwyer on Parks and Rec, and he had a very small role in Zero Dark Thirty.
I was about to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there was something there. I was like, ah, he had this one role. I was like, who's the guy that's this generation's Tom Hanks? Because in the 80s, remember Tom Hanks, Bosom Buddies, he's doing all the comedy. And then he takes a risk with Philadelphia.
Right.
And from then, he could do anything else that he wanted. I was like, who's that guy that needs to take a risk that's kind of known for being more fun and that sort of thing? Because I need a likable character as well. And I thought, that's Chris Pratt.
And willing to drop a few pounds.
Back then, exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Same as Tom Hanks, right?
Yeah, that's for Castaway.
That's right.
Well, Philadelphia.
Oh, and Philadelphia, right?
Come on, Jim.
Yep.
Jesus Christ.
Yep, big time.
Sorry,
big
I didn't
time.
Love that movie as much as you guys do.
And so what was crazy, though, is that I had no connection to him, no connection to anybody in Hollywood. And then right before the book came out, well, like 4 months before it comes out, I get this call from an old buddy of mine in the SEAL teams, and I hadn't talked to him in about 5 years. And he says, hey, I always wanted to call you and thank you for what you did for me in the SEAL teams. And I couldn't even remember what it was. And he said, you sat me down, you talked to me about transition, you introduced me to people in the private sector. Nobody else took the time to do that. And I always wanted to thank you. And I said, no problem. And then he said, I heard you have a book coming out. And I said, yeah, I have a book coming out. I can send you a rough draft. It comes out in a few months. And he said, well, I'd like to give it to a friend of mine. And I'm like, yeah, no problem. Who's that? And he said, Chris Pratt. And so Chris read it in December of 2017. And January 2018, he called and wanted to option it. So,
nice.
So yeah, we were off to the races. And now we're filming. And Antoine Fuqua was directing. And it's 350 people on set there in L.A. And it's, wow. It's incredible to see it all come together. It's just completely surreal.
What network, if that's even a term anymore, is it, it going to be on?
Amazon Prime. Sometime in 2022. But
and it's shooting in L.A.? And,
yeah, shooting
that's,
in L.A.
That's good to know.
It's crazy.
Harbinger of good things.
Yeah, it's amazing to be out there and seeing how they do all these, all the stunts. And it's very much like a military operation. You have Kraft Food Services is like the Army logistics chain feeding everybody. You have the explosives guy there. You have the mobility transportation guy moving the cars around, just like we have in the platoon. You have the weapons guy you're trading your weapons with, and he's marking off as the actors get back and hand them in at the end of the day. And then you have Antoine as this like CO, the commanding officer, who's setting the tone up here. And you have Chris as like the platoon commander, troop commander at that tactical level, setting the tone there. So it's very much like a military operation.
Wow. What?
A more fun.
But so clairvoyant, prescient, I guess, of you to...
Jack calls it Beshert.
Beshert, to be thinking about the guy from Parks and Rec playing that part.
Yeah.
And small in Zero Dark Thirty. I'm trying to...
It was a small part. He was part of SEAL Team 6, the last third of the movie. Remember, the Bin Laden raid.
Yeah.
Wow. Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal? When it comes to great rates on insurance for everything, Geico can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance. They are all covered with Geico. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use Geico mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to Geico. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.
And that was Jack Carr from May of last year. And that will do it for today's Memorial Day episode. Stick around tomorrow. The Adam Carolla Show returns. We're going to be celebrating Adam's birthday, which was actually on Friday, but we recorded it on Adam's birthday. And Dana Gould's in studio, so you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're going to play some Rotten Tomatoes game, Huel's Jewels.
Oh, wow.
We're really going to get into it. So tune in, because you know it's going to be a hell of an episode. And Gio and I will see you next weekend. Thanks again for listening. Thanks again for sharing with a friend. Thanks again for listening. Thanks again for sharing with a friend. My name's Chris Loxamana. That's Super Fan Giovanni.
Well, and get it on.
Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal? When it comes to great rates on insurance for everything, Geico can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance, they are all covered with Geico. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use Geico mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to Geico. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.